Hello, Vashon, and welcome to Real Talk. I'm Susan McCabe, your host, and Real Talk is the show about anything. Anything that piques my interest and hopefully yours, dear listener. You have topics you want to explore. I will find an expert to get you the answers. Just send me your requests to realtalk@voiceofvashon.org. And I want to thank Windermere Real Estate, Vashon, for their support for all Voice of Vashon's community information programming. They make shows like Real Talk, Island Crossroads, and many other of our community information programs possible. Today, our topic is journalism in the world of alternative facts, fake news, and who's telling the truth. And I am delighted to have with me Eugene Carlson, veteran reporter who's been around to see the changes in journalism and is still working in that field. He's a former Wall Street Journal reporter and editor and founder of Crosscut, contributing editor to Crosscut, which is a successful online news agency. Welcome, Gene. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Susan. It's nice to be here. Great topic on the 4th of July.
Absolutely.
One of the founders of Crosscut, by
one
the way,
of the
actually, David Brewster, who's well known around Seattle, he gets credit for the germ of the idea, but a bunch of us sort of pitched in and got it off the ground.
Well, tell us a little bit about Crosscut. How did it get started? How do we find it? How do we use it?
Well, Crosscut is a digital newspaper. It is only, you can find it online at crosscut.com. We are publishing three or four meaty stories about things of interest in the metro Seattle, Western Washington area, politics, city hall, police, transportation, economics, you name it. And it was David Brewster's idea. He was the founder of the Seattle Weekly, thought that with the rise of digital news, online news, that there ought to be a way to do the same alternative news site news coverage in online format. And so it got off the ground. And it's an idea that has actually been replicated in a number of cities and locales around the country, most successfully in Texas with an organization called the Texas Tribune. It's probably the single most powerful news site of any sort in the state of Texas now. It's quite remarkable, and it's worth anybody who's interested in the news, take a look at the Texas Tribune.
TexasTribune.com, I would take it.
That'll do it. .org.
Oh, non-for-profit.
Non-for-profit. And actually, Crosscut is a .com. We started out as a for-profit, but switched quite some time ago to a nonprofit status. And we are now partners with Channel 9, KCTS, in a venture called Cascade Public Media. So Channel 9 is one arm of that, and Crosscut is the other. And we're great partners. We're supplying a lot of the digital news for Channel 9, KCTS.
Nice to know that sort of thing is happening here in our region and available to all of us on Vashon and throughout the Northwest.
By the way, I would say Dan Chasen, who many Vashoners know, has been a regular contributor to Crosscut and with a lot of interesting stories. He's a wonderful writer.
He is a wonderful writer, an attorney, and I believe he's still on the school board for Vashon Island
School District.
We have folks of many talents here, and I want to get to yours, especially the experience that you can share with us. I got involved in journalism in the 70s and was inspired by Woodward and Bernstein and their investigations of the Nixon administration. Those were the days when good journalists were respected. He chuckles over there. Tell us what it was like then, how you did reporting then, and how does it compare to now?
Well, all of us admired Woodward and Bernstein, as well as many other great reporters who didn't have get quite the popular notoriety that they did. I started out, as did a lot of people who are still active in journalism, believe it or not, writing on a manual typewriter. So over the years, our career in journalism has really paralleled the change in journalism as a whole. It was a time where you had newspapers, you had three broadcast networks, you had two or three popular news magazines and radio, and that's how people got their news. And that didn't change for many, many decades. But now technology has given us a whole new ballgame. Newspaper advertising is now in its death spiral. Cable TV has given us hundreds of news channels, not just three. Many of them are news sites. And we receive our news on little personal devices, our own little personal Google machines that we walk around with in our pocket. We have sites like BuzzFeed and Vox and Recode, which sounded weird to anybody 3 or 4 years ago, and are now among incredibly respected sites delivering great news content. And we have social media. Facebook just announced that it now has 2 billion users.
Oh my God.
And for a lot of those people, they are not just sending pictures of their family and friends and exchanging recipes. They're receiving news through Facebook. And at Crosscut, we find that more than half of the people who see our stories come to us not because they go to crosscut.com and log on. They get it because somebody on Facebook said, this is a great story, you should read it. Or they put it on their timeline and it gets picked up that way. So between Facebook, between Instagram, between Twitter, we have an entirely new way that news is being delivered. And while people, older people of my generation, certainly not yours, Susan, but of my generation, have had to be pushed screaming into reluctantly
into
learning this thing. And some have simply said, I'm just too old. I'm not going to do that. People much, much younger, this is just a way of life and this is the way it's going to be.
It is. And it makes me wonder, how do the consumers of news and the reporters who are working on legitimate news organizations, whether they're digital or not, verify the truth in this world of alternative facts, which is actually a term, in my view, for lies. How does one verify the facts and figure out what you can believe?
Well, we wouldn't be having that conversation, and you wouldn't have asked me that question if there wasn't a large body of conversation out there that said that there are no such things as facts anymore. The news is all fake and so on. So we can go on to that. But in answer to your question, you verify stories the old-fashioned way. You call sources that you believe in. You get, if you have a good story, you try and verify it with more than one source, and most good newspapers will not let stories in the paper. Unless they have more than one good source, you spend days and weeks and years cultivating people who know what they're talking about and who you can trust, and you develop a relationship with them, and they know that they can trust you, and you do a lot of reading, and you do a lot of snooping around. That's the way it's always been done, and that's the way it's still done.
Well, the current administration is the purveyor of the idea of fake news, which is generally real news that they don't want to hear. How does a reporter convince their audience that what they are providing is real news? How do you cut through the confusion that is created by those declarations?
It's a hard question because, I mean, it's difficult to answer that. I think you just have to keep doing what you're doing. Keep on coming on, because I think most people in this business feel that we are now living in an aberration, that this is a wrinkle in time. You know, it's a really unusual situation, and that sooner or later, sanity will be restored. And we'll go back to doing it the old-fashioned way. That is where the press is an adversary, that the press believes it's working to get facts and stories out that may not please one party or it may not please another party, but that is, in fact, interesting, useful, important news that the press believes the public should know, and they will... They will write that. We will write that, and we won't have this orchestra in the balcony shouting that this story is fake and incorrect and shouldn't be believed and so on. That may be an optimistic view because the. Proliferation of news now on cable and in different online sites is now segmented pretty drastically between, call them liberal sites and right-wing sites or alternative news and real news. You still have the press establishment, but you have sites on both ends of the political spectrum that are very powerful and reaching a lot of people. And it'll be hard, I think, maybe to go back to squeeze that back into the tube, you know?
Because people really now have the option of listening to news that agrees with whatever they think, whether or not it's true.
That's right. So I should acknowledge that. But at least I think that hopefully there will be someone at the head of the executive branch who won't be using the bully pulpit as a bully and Of whatever party, we'll go back to that normal, and that will be helpful.
Well, let's go to that, because the current head of the executive party, or executive branch rather, has basically blocked media from the White House. What do you see there as the implications for press freedom in general? That gives me the chills, because how far is that sort of repression going to go?
Yeah, it should give you the chills. It should give everyone pause. And to talk about that, you should realize that this is something that is really specific, site-specific to the White House. Certainly, passions and politics are running red hot in Congress. But congressional leaders, Republican, Democrat, brief reporters multiple times every week. Credentialed reporters can walk through the halls of Congress and they can spot a member of Congress and talk to him or her, buttonhole them, put them on camera. Happens all the time. And so there's a, and although someone did suggest a while back that they ought to limit press access, that was quickly dropped by members of leaders of both parties and so on. So
that's good news.
That's happened. The White House is a whole different kettle of fish now, and it is something that we've really never seen before. In that you have a press secretary and a press staff that has drastically limited the normal press briefings. They have, in many cases, not limited them in coverage and in television coverage, and limited them in the number of ones that they're having, limited the reporters that they talk to, and the president doesn't have press conferences as such anymore. And a couple of times that they meet, he will tend to call on some obscure reporter that he finds has some favor with and so on. So it's a really hard situation for reporters to deal with. And reporters, they don't take kindly to this. Reporters have been in the White House press corps, have been doing this a long time. And there has been a modus vivendi, a way of working Republican presidents, Democratic presidents, where you can ask tough questions, but everybody understands the role and things get done. It can be a little rocky at times, but everybody understands both sides, and it's to the advantage of everybody to work that way. For example, just one little item. The typically a press secretary will say, all right, this is what's going to happen for the day. Here's the president's schedule. And then there will be a lid from 6 o'clock until 10 o'clock the next day. A lid meaning you don't have to be here. We're not going to be any news. We're not going to be putting out anything.
Oh, I see.
Or there'll be a lid from 11 o'clock to 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So you all can go out to lunch. Don't worry about it. We're not going to spring anything on you. And so it's that kind of guidance that makes life sort of worth living.
So there's been a partnership that allows some sort of access to information.
It's a partnership, yeah. And just to put a footnote on that, now you have a president who is his own announcer, and reporters who are on this beat never get a lid, really, because they're never sure when the president is going to tweet something. And tweeting is a whole new subject that could take us quite a while.
So
it's a different thing. Nicole Wallace, a MSNBC commentator now, and George Bush's former press aide, and so on. She calls it a goat rodeo in the White House. I think it's a wonderful description.
Goat rodeo. For those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to Real Talk at 101.9 FM KVSHLP Vashon Island, Washington. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, with my guest, Gene Carlson, who is a veteran Wall Street Journal journalist and current one of the co-founders of Crosscut and a contributing editor to that online news agency. We're talking about journalism in the world of alternative facts, fake news, and leaks. So, what's a leak?
Well, a leak is a piece of information that is generally thought to be confidential, and in press parlance, gets given to a reporter. And it is often thought of in kind of evil terms by the thing. This is something that never should be done. And in fact, there are cases when leaks of information in the national security business are, in fact, are illegal. Doesn't sound. But in the broader context, leaks happen all the time, and the government is the biggest leaker of all. There's just cases every day in a reporter's life in Washington, no matter where you are, where you will get information from some government official who said, look, I can't put my name on this, but let me just tell you that this is happening, or for your guidance, you should talk to her. You know, I suggest you do this, or here's a piece of paper you might want to find interesting. Reporters, being smart cookies, realize often that the information they're getting is something that is very self-serving for the government, but it's news. And so you do your normal fact-checking and come around and try and see it from the other side, and it often results from a story. Interesting that the biggest leak, self-admitted leak that we had recently was from Jim Comey, the director of the FBI.
Oh, yes.
Who admitted that he leaked his famous memo of his conversations with the president to a friend who he knew would leak it, pass it on to the paper. He felt and admitted that this was something that was in the public interest, and he just simply couldn't hand it out himself. So he did that, and so on. But there is, in this climate, and it's one of the things that people find very troubling about this climate, that the president has said things that are simply not accurate, not true, and that people in government, often very highly placed, have felt that it is really their obligation to set the record straight. And so they have passed on information to reporters. And I will tell you, in many cases, at enormous personal risk in terms of their careers and in terms of their potential prosecution.
It is almost as if Trump is suppressing the truth that, quote, leakers try to get out if they're in a position to see things that are not being done correctly or that are patently wrong, then it is suppressed. And the term leak, by making the term leak a negative and pejorative term, almost an accusation of illegality.
One of the most remarkable debates we had in the press, as Trump's influence began to rise and so on, is whether or not is a, over the word lie. So lie is a very accusatory word, and it is used. Reporters have always shied away from that, and so on. And no more. This the word lie. The president is lying, is used all the time now. It was a difficult bridge to cross, but it simply happened because, in fact, the president does lie all the time over issues of importance and of issues like the size of his inaugural audience that are simply absurd. He does it all the time, just quickly, I think I remember a quote from during his campaign that I will tell you that seems to me ought to be remembered because it tells you a lot about Trump's mode of operation. He said, "You know, you have to brand people a certain way when you're they're your opponents, he told that and so on. The word brand. And you remember, it was Crooked Hillary. It was Lion Ted Cruz. It was little Marco Rubio. It was low energy Jeb Bush. Now it's the failing New York Times. And it's fake CNN. It worked for him in his political campaign, and is simply translated now into how he's putting information out. It is just a completely different mindset. I think he sees that as a successful mode of operation, and he's continued to do it.
And he continues to remain in competition rather than pulling the country together, which is what his job is supposed to be. And it makes me wonder if indeed that sort of branding works in our current culture because of the lack of education or the lack of interest in stories that have depth, in information that has depth. How do you see this sort of strategy working for him with the general public? Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, it seems to be working pretty well for his supporters. If you look at the traffic that Fox News, the ratings of Fox's, which and the traffic at sites like Breitbart and even more extreme sites, they're gathering. They have good audiences, and they have an enthusiastic following.
Are they growing?
And so, yeah, I can't tell you about ratings, but I have no reason to believe that they're getting any less. It's still a very, very strong segment, and no matter what the holes that have been poked in these various stories, they seem to still get information. I have very quickly, we all may remember the Pizzagate story in Washington. It's close to my heart because it's a restaurant in my daughter's neighborhood, and I've been there many, many times. And a young man came up, spurred on by the ranting of Alex Jones, a radio commentator, who said that this was the headquarters of Hillary Clinton's pedophile operation. The young man was absurd. He drove up and walked into that restaurant and shot off his rifle. And he is now doing 4 years in federal penitentiary.
Well, that's good.
But Alex Jones continues to talk on. So there you go.
Yeah, and one of the others, maybe it was Alex Jones, who was here at University of Washington, caused some excitement as well. I can't remember exactly when it was, but some. But
it actually wasn't it. Alex Jones, but
it was somebody from Breitbart.
Yeah. And I've forgotten the young man's name, but it was, and so on.
We have just 1 minute left here on Real Talk with Gene Carlson. I am so delighted to have you here. Parting words?
Parting words, yes, because this has been a bit of a down conversation in a way, and it's the 4th of July, and we haven't even mentioned the First Amendment, which we've been dancing around.
Yes.
It's what gives us the power to the authority to have this conversation.
Absolutely.
And there are many, many wonderful quotes over the years about the First Amendment and so on from great people. How about this one? The freedom of speech may be taken away, and dumb and silent, we may be led like sheep to the slaughter. Well, it's a down statement, but we understand the meaning of the importance of the press there. That was from George Washington in 1783 to officers of the Continental Army. I think those are words to live by.
Thank you, Gene Carlson. They certainly are words to live by. And thank you, listeners, for joining us here on Real Talk. Next week, we're going to talk about dirt and the impact of the degradation of soil on your nutrition. This has been Real Talk, and I want to thank Windermere Vachon Real Estate for sponsoring Real Talk and all our community information programming here on The Voice of Vachon. This is Real Talk special feature, Lyons on Literature. That is Mary Fran Lyons, our version of Nancy Pearl, right here on Vachon Island, giving us great book reviews. Well, Mary Fran, welcome.
Thank you. Susan told me I'm inspiring her to read these books, so I feel very affirmed by that. So the book that
you're a missionary.
The book that I want to talk about today is by an author named Blaine Harden, B-L-A-I-N-E, last name H-A-R-D-E-N, and the name of the book is Escape from Camp 14. Blaine is a local Northwest author, and he's been here on Vachon talking about things, and as best I can tell about Blaine Harden is that whatever grabs his fancy, he writes about, and he writes about really well. And there seems to be the center of gravity right now is tilting toward Korea, so that's the book that we're talking about today.
Right?
North Korea, correct. And so this book is about a young man who managed to escape from one of the gulags in North Korea. So the average North Korean person has a really, really rough life, and we've discussed that in some of our other segments. This would be like North Korea's version of their concentration camps. And what they do in North Korea is if you're a political enemy or you've done something that they would interpret as treason or something serious, you basically go to these camps for the rest of your life. Mm. And it's pretty bad. It's a lot of hard labor. You're assigned jobs and this and that and the other. This young gentleman, his name is Shin Dong-hyuk. His parents actually conceived him when they were given a reward marriage in one of these camps. So his mother and his father both had done things that landed them in a camp. I can't even remember what it was. I think his father did something that was interpreted as treason. Frankly, I have a hard time imagining how he could grow up to have any sort of functionality whatsoever.
Yeah.
Because as you think about, you know, this sort of thing, they've documented that, you know, tiny infants in hospitals die if you don't love them and caress them because it's a biological need. So who knows how this happened? Anyway,
he was raised in a concentration camp?
He was raised in a concentration camp.
By his parents, or was he separated from them?
Well, he was with his parents off and on as a very young kid. So, for example, his mother would come home and cook dinner, but it did not sound like any sort of normal sort of life because often there wasn't much food. As he describes the way he lived, it's almost like he was living like an animal because so much of what he did was about just finding food. So, for example, he became expert at trapping and cooking rats and things like that, you know, are just, it's just protein. I mean, so anyway, fast forward to some very, very rough times where he betrayed his mother and his brother. I mean, this is not a person who has what we would consider to have normal human emotions. I don't know if they were even planning on it because, again, I'm getting ahead of myself here, but it's come out and that a lot of parts of his story were inaccurate, that he basically made up a story and told that story for years, but now is amending it and changing it. But whatever, his mother and his brother were executed. And in the original book, he was part of betraying them when they were talking about defecting. And so he came and watched the execution and was still angry at his brother because they put him in a bad situation. I mean, these are not normal human emotions. He then later something happened and he was tortured, put over a fire, put in a cell where he was nursed by some nice older prisoner. Otherwise, he could easily have died. And then ultimately was in a camp where he was able to escape across this electrified fencing, which he touched and it burned him badly, but he was able to escape to China. And things were such that it sounded like it was destined to be. As he's said more, it appears that, again, it was not as straightforward because at different times with the border with China, North Korean China has been relatively porous. North Korean leadership knowing that people are starving and the only way they can get food is if it comes across from China or whatever. So they let things happen as long as nothing that they can see so terrible is happening. Anyway, so he gets to, you know, what we would consider the normal world. And now this poor kid is trying to rebuild his life and not just learn, you know, about cell phones and ATMs, but just learn how to relate to people in a normal way. He's become very active in the human rights community, justifiably so. He's amended the story of how he did what he did and how he accomplished the escape a number of times, to the point where Blaine Harden has written a foreword to the book saying, now I don't know what to believe, because, you know, and it doesn't matter, though, because the scars on his body and the stories that he's telling, while technically unverifiable to any significant degree, certainly would bear consistency with what other escapees have told about what happens in Korea. They've looked at satellite photos of these concentration camps and other things that, you know, that would verify that these structures in fact exist. So that the actual chapter and verse, this is what happened, that he says may not be exactly right, but certainly the gentleman lived through hell.
And well, the brain of an abuse victim is messy.
Another interesting thing about this, and it's been pointed out with some of the other reading that I've done on North Korea, is even the people that aren't in such a horrible situation as this young man, that are just, you know, chapter and verse North Koreans, when they come out, they have a very hard time establishing themselves in what we would consider modern society, where you have choices about what you're going to do, but you have to have some initiative about, you know, going and getting a job and actually performing in the job and doing, you know, you think, oh, good, they finally got away. And it turns out they've really been robbed of a lot more than just some years. They've really been robbed of the ability to just adjust and learn as they were growing up and young adults and just figuring out how to operate in the world as we know it.
It's almost as though their brains are frozen at a certain level.
Yes. Another example of that, for example, I happen to know a lost boy from the Sudan, and as I met other ones, tremendous. They didn't just lose their childhood. No, they really lost the ability to just be happy and comfortable and content and serene in the world as we know it, where you can think what you like and say what you want and buy what you like and eat what you like. I mean, it just isn't like that. These people that come from places where they're just so repressed in their development.
Developmentally arrested. Mary Fran Lyon on Escape from Camp 14 by Blaine Harden, a Northwest author.
Thanks for having me, Susan.
Thank you, Mary Fran. It's always interesting.